طفلة تمتطيه قوس قزح، طفلة.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, a weekly broadcast of news, analysis, commentary, and discussion of issues relevant to the Palestinian struggle for freedom from Israel's brutal occupation and colonization of their homeland. The purpose of This Week in Palestine is to feature the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian voice that is too often missing in the presentation of news and analysis in the American mainstream media. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham, and we continue it in his memory. This is John Roberts. We begin this week with a rather discouraging but accurate analysis of the European Union's refusal to stand up to Israel, even when they are stealing it blind. Like the United States, the EU is putty in the hands of Israel. Israel illegally takes land and property, and none of the major powers stand up to them. This trend is underscored in the following report by the human rights organization B'Tselem, which does an amazing job monitoring and reporting on the human rights abuses of the military occupation. I now quote from their report. Israel has announced that it will auction off two prefabricated buildings that have been donated to Palestinians by the European Union. In October, Israel's occupation forces confiscated the structures that were part of a school for dozens of children in Ibzik, a community in the north of the occupied West Bank. Israel's brazenness generated consternation on social media. Even the EU foreign policy spokesperson, Maya Kozajancic, tweeted that the decision was incredible. But when Kozajancic delivered the EU's official response at the press briefing on Monday, she indicated that it would be business as usual. Israel can do as it likes, and the EU will take it lying down. When the structures were seized last year, the EU missions in Jerusalem and Ramallah called on Israeli authorities to return the confiscated items to their intended beneficiaries without precondition as soon as possible. Otherwise, Israel was to provide compensation without delay for the dismantled and confiscated assets. The EU expects its investment in support of the Palestinian people to be protected from damage and destruction, Kozajancic said. But Israel hasn't compensated the EU, rebuilt the schools, protected the EU's investments, or the people of Izbik, who have been the targets of repeated Israel attacks. Instead, Israel has continued its widespread assault on Palestinian schools across the occupied West Bank, particularly in Area C. Area C is approximately 60% of the occupied West Bank that is fully controlled by Israel under the Oslo Accords signed in the 1990s. The EU still believes this land will make up the bulk of a future Palestinian state, even as it becomes clear that Israeli leaders, backed by the Trump administration, are moving towards annexing it to Israel. Kozajancic did reaffirm that the place where the confiscation took place is occupied territory, and that under international law, Israel has the obligation to protect and facilitate development for the local population and to grant unimpeded access for humanitarian assistance. But there was no inkling that the EU would do anything either to enforce international law or to make Israel pay for its theft. The following question was asked. Can you confirm that the EU plans to take no action whatsoever to hold Israel accountable for what has been done? I can't confirm something that I didn't say, Kosacianic replied. Our position is very clear from my answer. The only thing that is clear is that the European Union will continue to allow Israel to shoot children dead in cold blood, demolish schools, and build even more colonies on stolen Palestinian land, and the only thing Israel need fear is a few mild words of rebuke. In the meantime, the EU will continue to lavish money on Israel and its war industry, sending a message that is clearly understood by Israel's government. Crime pays. Indeed, as Kosacianic was delivering her empty statement on Israel's theft of the school buildings, EU officials were welcoming an Israeli delegation to Brussels to learn from each other in addressing common domestic and regional threats and challenges. End of quote. That was a report by the Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem. Okay, let's get to our feature presentation, which this week is a talk delivered to this year's annual conference of the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs in Washington, D.C., delivered by Grant Smith of the Institute for Research for Middle East Policy and a frequent contributor to the Al Jazeera News Service, speaking on Israel's clandestine nuclear program, which to this day it continues to absurdly claim does not exist. And of course, because Israel wants to continue this charade of non-existence, we go along with it. Another illustration of Israel's gross manipulation of the United States and the EU. Here is Grant Smith's speech with a portion of the Q&A period.
So before starting, I haven't had a chance to introduce the Institute for Research Middle Eastern Policy, co-organizer of this conference. We're an organization that began doing Middle East policy research in 2002. And as part of that research, we did keep running into the Israel lobby and its multiple policies and programs. And so the Institute for Research has three core programs, many of which focus on the lobby. The first one of those programs is Freedom of Information Act requests. The Freedom of Information Act is in a period right now where any real bona fide effort is going to require a lawsuit to complete. And we have multiple lawsuits going on at any single time. But the purpose of Freedom of Information Act lawsuits is really to ferret out information that the government has kept secret about Middle East policy making that Americans should know. So our second major program, as Delinda mentioned at the top of the hour, was our effort to do public opinion polling that asks, in many cases, questions at the mainstream pollsters, whether Gallup or Pew or Rasmussen, do not ask about U.S. Middle East policy. There's a huge wide range of questions that they will never ask about U.S. foreign aid, about what they think about Middle East nuclear proliferation. And so what we've done with our polling is using the Google Surveys platform, which is a representative polling process that costs money, attempt to ask those questions and track Gallup in particular, which has, even within the polling world, many polls about the Middle East that are extreme outliers with even other pollsters like Pew Research, but certainly with our polling. And so finally, we put together research reports and data we've gathered through FOIA and polling results and other sources to publish policy research. It often appears online at antiwar.com. It's published by the Washington Report on Middle East Affairs. And we think that this research that we've been performing has potential to reduce a lot of the enormous waste and misdirected efforts and huge opportunity costs that we've been paying as a nation. So today I'd like to talk about the Israeli nuclear weapons program. It's a topic that is of interest because back in the 1960s, as Professor Hickson mentioned this morning, the United States correctly opposed the Israelis going nuclear. And nevertheless, the U.S. effort to make nonproliferation a key policy goal was undermined. I call it supplanted. And so we're going to go through a few details about that, because everybody in this room, everybody watching this in one way or another, has paid a price as U.S. obligations under treaty and our own Arms Export Control Act have been systematically undermined for 50 years. And so what we need to do is that understanding the root cause of this undermining leads directly to the Israel lobby. They want you to pay, they want you to continue paying, but they would prefer that you do not know what is going on so it can continue indefinitely. So I'm going to basically base a lot of the points I'm making on three concurrent lawsuits that are happening right now in D.C. District Court. And one of them is about obtaining the entire black budget for U.S. foreign aid to Israel, which is very large but never disclosed. The other is to expose a new gag order that came out in 2012, which bans all U.S. federal workers and contractors from discussing the Israeli nuclear weapons program. And finally, a newly unearthed part of nuclear ambiguity policy, which are secret letters signed by presidents promising, in effect, to violate NPT and our arms export control regime. So Professor Hickson already mentioned this morning, this era in the 1960s, at the end of it, where the policy goals of the entire U.S. policymaking community for the Israeli nuclear weapons program were to compel Israel to sign the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, to uphold U.S. obligations under that treaty, withhold the sale of nuclear delivery-capable Phantom jets from Israel that they wanted to buy, and compel the Israelis to dismantle their Dimona nuclear weapons facility. Their consensus, as stated in a memo compiled by National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger, was to avert a disaster in terms of the peace process. They felt nuclear weapons would, quote, sharply reduce the chances for any peace settlement in the near future, unquote. And boy, were they ever right. The Israeli policy goals were to buy those nuclear-capable jet fighters, to maintain their Dimona facility, and to get the United States to enter into an Israeli-contrived policy of forever being ambiguous about whether they did or did not have a nuclear weapons program. And so these two policy objectives were fundamentally opposed, and the United States' decision factors really rotated around the Nixon assessment of the Israel lobby's ability to mount pressure upon them. Henry Kissinger noted that if they made public the fact that they were going to base sales of these jets on the nuclear program, that enormous pressure would be mounted on them by the lobby. And previous presidents, as Professor Hickson had alluded to, had already collapsed under this very same pressure, that they couldn't pressure the Israelis without immediately having U.S.-based groups come to them and say, you can't do this. And so there was another consideration within the policy compilation, which they all considered, and this is something most Americans don't know about, but there was concern because they knew that the Israelis had in fact stolen weapons-grade uranium from the United States beginning in about 1965 from a plant in Apollo, Pennsylvania. And as Kissinger said, this is one program on which the Israelis have persistently deceived us and may have even stolen from us. Subsequent document releases from the CIA and FBI leave no doubt about that. But what happened ultimately was that with all of these policy considerations out in the table, the Nixon administration nevertheless adopted an Israeli policy of nuclear ambiguity and sold the jets in a meeting with Golda Meir on September 26, 1969. And ever since, United States presidents have, while in office, mostly abided by a policy of never confirming, denying, or talking about the Israeli nuclear weapons programs, just as most Israeli prime ministers do not. But there were two senators who were not satisfied and made some trouble for the CIA and the National Security Council. These were Senators Stuart Symington and John Glenn. And although they couldn't compel in numerous meetings with the Central Intelligence Agency, couldn't compel any action on their part or on the part of the NSC or anybody else to do anything about the diversion, they did pass an amendment to the U.S. Foreign Assistance Act, which is now part of the Arms Export Control Act, which provides conditions that the U.S. has to follow if it ever wants to transfer foreign aid to a nuclear weapons state that has not signed the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. Nevertheless, the United States has never followed its own law. And so from our standpoint as Freedom of Information Act users, we hit a wall every time we move to attempt to make the Central Intelligence Agency, the State Department, or any other agency release information about the Israeli nuclear weapons program. The CIA has released things before. In 1974, they released a special national security estimate, which leaves no doubt that they know the Israelis have nuclear weapons. The Department of Defense, after fighting us in court for half a year, released a very lengthy 1987 analysis of the Israeli nuclear development program, which included hydrogen bomb development, which included using U.S. resources provided under Adams for Peace for making nuclear weapons designs. And so the U.S. government can fight these things, but they're with 50 years of history, 50 years of slip-ups in releasing information, there's plenty of compelling evidence that we've been able to use to convince judges that at this point, the only possible reason that they're still maintaining a lot of this information under classification is that they don't want anybody to come after them and challenge them on the laws and the treaty that they're breaking. And so nuclear ambiguity has been around for so long that it requires heavy maintenance and in this day and age to maintain. And so New Yorker reporter Adam Entos wrote a stunning piece in June of 2018 in which he talked about a series of letters that the Israelis have been making presidents sign since Bill Clinton in 1993 until Donald Trump more recently, in which they promise in a letter, a secret letter, that they will not compel the Israelis to sign the NPT, they will not talk about Israel's nuclear weapons in public. And of course, the National Archives and Records Administration will and is fighting not to even confirm the existence of these letters. But it is clear that they are part of ambiguity maintenance. And this ambiguity maintenance has even taken another form in which the Obama administration, after being very positive in talking about nuclear nonproliferation, in talking about a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, finally buckled to pressure and not only signed a letter, but also passed a new classification guideline, which says essentially that any government employee, any government contractor, that even so much as references information about the Israeli nuclear weapons program from the public domain will be fired, prosecuted, lose their security clearance, or possibly much worse. And so this has already happened to one Department of Energy employee by the name of James Doyle, who used to work at Los Alamos National Laboratory. James Doyle made the mistake of writing a single article called "Why Eliminate Nuclear Weapons?" in a magazine called Survival, the February-March edition from 2013. And so James Doyle wrote the following, quote, "Nuclear weapons did not deter Egypt and Syria from attacking Israel in 1973, Argentina from attacking the British in the Falklands War, or Iraq from attacking Israel in the 1991 Gulf War," unquote. Clear reference to Israel's nukes not being a great conventional deterrent. But a congressional staffer noticed that he had written this. That representative's office contacted the Department of Energy, hugely dependent on Congress's good graces for funding. They looked at the article, which they had already reviewed for classified information, and then they retroactively reclassified it, raided Doyle's home, fired him, pulled his security clearances, and that's how it works. So if we look at some of the costs of nuclear ambiguity policy, one way to do that is to look at all of the foreign aid that's been given since Symington and Glenn first managed to pass their restrictions on foreign aid to non-MPT states. And if you look at the aid figures, which are never given in inflation-adjusted terms, that foreign aid since 1949 has now surpassed $260.9 billion. And again, this does not include any of the black budget aid, which we still haven't been able to release. So that's far more than the United States spent rebuilding Europe under the Marshall Plan. It's far more aid than given to any other foreign country. And it's interesting then to take a data cut of that aid and see that 85% of that foreign aid has been given to Israel since the Symington and Glenn amendments became law in 1976. And so by law, none of that almost $250 million should have been allowed, absent some Arms Export Control Act compliance and absent some Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty compliance. If you look at how much aid has been given since President Clinton, President George W. Bush, President Obama, President Trump acquiesced to signing new pledges to Israel to promise to ignore their weapons, to promise to ignore the NPT and U.S. law, the amount is $99.9 billion. Let's round it up to 100. And so Israel's demands have another component, and this again goes back to the concerns expressed in the report about entering ambiguity in the first place, and that is the cleanup of the toxic waste site left by the plant that Henry Kissinger referred to. The Nuclear Materials and Equipment Corporation was, as the CIA once said, an Israeli operation from the beginning. And yet, because the NUMEC diversion information gathered by the CIA, gathered by the FBI, gathered by other parties has never fully been released, The cleanup costs and the blame for this toxic waste left by this underfunded plant have been shifted onto other parties. And so the FBI has documents indicating they know that underfunding and shoddy treatment of protocols on waste handling contributed to the toxic pollution at Apollo, Pennsylvania, because they had wiretaps on the plant owners talking about the results of a toxic spill in which they were sending unprotected workers to go make cleanups. But the U.S. Corps of Army Engineers is estimating this $500 billion toxic cleanup will have to be paid by U.S. taxpayers. And so I think the story of nuclear ambiguity, the costs that it transfers to U.S. taxpayers, the pretty much illegitimate discussion that comes around nuclear nonproliferation in policymaking circles can be traced back to this particular nuclear ambiguity policy. But what's interesting about it is that it's not unique. If you look at other policies, you can see a cycle at work: supplant, silence, and exploit. Supplanting, devise an original or supplant a policy of the United States that benefits the United States with one that broadly benefits Israel is the supplantation stage. Silence, figure out a way to gag or prevent stakeholders or government employees, officials, contractors from effectively communicating about these supplanted interests. And then exploit, compel U.S. taxpayers, voters, businesses, others to provide resources for Israel and the lobby rather than the common good. So this is taking place and has taken place in other arenas. Ali Abu Nima mentioned that there was an organization back in the 1960s called the American Zionist Council, which was in fact ordered to register as an Israeli foreign agent because it received funding from Israel to start up and conduct public relations. But that same organization, along with pressure on the Justice Department, managed to supplant the U.S. Foreign Agents Registration Act and their desire to have open information on the money coming in and the policies being enacted, and silence the Justice Department through pure internal pressure into not even releasing the registration that was finally compelled in 1962. So the Justice Department held on to it until 2010. But there's a clear set of documents that shows that AIPAC was originally ordered when it was operating as an unincorporated organization inside the AZC to comply with a FARA order, and it never did. And the Justice Department never did anything about it, and they won't even talk about it. So that exploitation is that foreign agent activities immediately resumed for the Israeli government when AIPAC incorporated itself in 1963, just 6 weeks after that order. AZC's gone. AIPAC's been with us ever since. The First Amendment, and this is something that we'll be talking about more this afternoon, supplanting and conditioning the First Amendment where it pertains to people wanting to boycott Israel over its human rights issues. The silence part of the cycle is free speech activities seeking peaceful change through nonviolent protests. People are now being asked to sign waivers and pledges that they will not engage in that speech activity. And the exploitation basically is that if you don't sign as a government employee or contractor in many states now a pledge saying that you won't boycott Israel, then all of those revenues and opportunities are going to go to others more willing to prioritize Israel's policy objectives. And so this has happened in weapons smuggling. Telegy is a recent example of Textronix oscilloscopes being shipped to Israel for their nuclear weapons program. They were able to simply get a slap on the wrist for an export violation. But it's been going on since the very first Neutrality Act violations in the 1940s, where there was a major Israeli smuggling, weapons smuggling ring in the United States. Some people call it the Haganah smuggling ring. Others call it other things. But it was able to move a large number of conventional weapons out of this country to Israel with almost no criminal prosecutions. And what I'm hoping our friends from the Virginia Coalition on Human Rights will talk about this afternoon is another case of supplant, silence, and exploit called replacing textbook histories in the K-12 education system with what's essentially the Israeli government line on territories, settlements, and other things in order to spread a line of government propaganda basically through the textbooks. And so I'm not going to go into that. But I can express some hope in the sense that Americans are increasingly, if you ask them the right question, increasingly interested in seeing more proper regulation and governance in questions like this. A poll we conducted in August of 2018 asked Americans whether, given the fact that Arms Export Control Act laws to country govern foreign aid to countries with nuclear weapons programs that haven't signed the NPT, and the fact that Israel has signed the NPT, should those laws be enforced? 54.8% said yes. And so this is material, raw material. And someone just asked me before this, you know, how do we contact these people? Well, that's the work at hand. But raw material for building more representative rule of law governance in this country. People are clearly out there who are willing to and eager to see some of these things enforced. And so signs of hope are certainly that Americans are becoming better informed about some of the things the lobby's been doing. Hopefully they can grasp, if they have the spectacles of supplant, silence, and exploit, they might be able to see some things going on in their state or community. Courts are beginning to play a slightly more aggressive role and productive role in allowing people to question these things using our legal system, and Martin McMahon and Saqib Ali will talk about that. Some members of Congress are obviously demonstrating that they'd like to see more popular action. And most importantly, the institutionalization of groups who know something about what's been going on and are willing to take some action is my biggest hope. My biggest hope is seeing some of the groups, particularly that come to this conference year after year and hearing about their work, attacking the silence, which is the weakest point of the cycle and the one that we have the best chance of prevailing in as organizations, activists, and people willing to take more of a leadership role in these abuses. Thank you.
We have a couple of questions on the relationship between South Africa, apartheid South Africa, and Israel. And so the question is, what was the collaboration between Israel and apartheid South Africa to develop nuclear weapons?
Right. So someone noticed I skipped a couple slides in this presentation. What the 1974 CIA special report talking about Israel's nuclear weapons most feared was collaboration with South Africa and Taiwan. And so the Israelis did, in fact, sign a contract with PW Botha to sell them nuclear-tipped missiles, Jericho missiles. And Sasha Polikow-Saransky wrote an entire book about that after he obtained the documents from the post-apartheid government. So most people who are doing credible work on nuclear nonproliferation believe that the so-called Vela flash in the Indian Ocean in the 1976 was an Israeli nuclear test with South Africa. And so, yes, there we could do an entire day-long conference, and I hope someday we can, about the Israeli nuclear weapons program and just how much information there is out there about it. But the U.S. ignores, it will not accept officially that the Vela flash was an Israeli nuclear test. They don't accept the authenticity of the South African government document release that there was an attempted sale of turnkey weapon systems to the apartheid regime. And so just another example of your government at work under a supplanted policy of nuclear ambiguity.
Very good. Another question here. What can you say about President Carter's divulgence of Israel's nuclear weapons in 2008 and the aftermath?
Yeah, I can say something about that. So a judge won't accept that. A judge will say, well, Carter wasn't in office, so that's not really an authoritative official statement. So we're sorry, IRMEP. Nice try, but we're not going to release information based on the premise that it's already official that presidents have acknowledged the nuclear weapons program. Is Sam Husseini in the audience? No? Well, Sam Husseini is a reporter for the Institute for Public Accuracy who has done videos. All right. Done videos of major political figures in power. Condoleezza Rice, Dick Cheney, all running away from him and his camera crew when asked, excuse me, sir, does Israel have nuclear weapons? And you would not believe the circumlocutions that you see these people go through when Sam Husseini traps them with his camera. So doesn't matter, unfortunately.
All right. And we have someone wondering, what leverage does Israel use to compel U.S. presidents to sign the letters that you discussed?
Right. Well, according to the story, these nuclear ambiguity maintenance letters come at the worst possible moment. And so for President Trump, it was as he was facing the ouster of a general and dealing with all sorts of startup conflicts, and suddenly Dan Meridor of the embassy shows up with a letter saying, well, you have to sign this, Mr. President, because every other president three times before you signed them, and you have to do it. You have to give us this guarantee that you will not be as spontaneous with us as you are in a lot of things. And so he signed it, and apparently they were angered by it within the administration. They felt undue pressure. They felt like this was out of line, but they signed it.
I think we have time for one more question here. Can you touch on Shimon Peres's role in the nuclear armament of Israel and the Israeli-French relationship?
Absolutely. Four words. Father of the nuclear program, father of the Israeli nuclear program. And there's going to be a lot more history written when sort of the full set of classified documents come out about his role in making that come about. But as you say, Dale, we're moving to something far more important, which is going to be James North, who's going to be speaking about the New York Times. So I would like to say thank you very much.
That was Grant Smith of the Washington Institute for Research for the Middle East speaking in Washington, D.C. Before we go, we want to mention a disturbing situation reported by Liz Rose of Mondawise that gives illustration to the power of the Israeli lobby in censoring pro-Palestinian reportage and in this instance, curriculum development. She writes, and I'm quoting, just 8 days after an administrator offered public school teachers in Skokie, Illinois, the opportunity to take summer professional development course called Teaching Palestine, the school district retracted the offer in a statement from top administrators apologizing for the hurtful, quote, one-sided nature of this course, unquote. They wrote, "We then heard from teachers and members of our community who were concerned about the one-sided nature of this course that addresses a very complex topic. We recognize that without multiple perspectives surrounding this topic, we created a sense of exclusion by including this offering. We should have noted this before including the course and apologized for this mistake. Therefore, we are retracting the course from the list of offerings that we shared. The district's decisions to silence any discourse about Palestine history with pressure from Zionist groups isn't surprising or new. But it's important to call attention to public schools that continue to conflate criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism, especially when the opportunity to take the course was shut down by two district administrators, along with the director of equity, an administrative position whose job description includes providing opportunities of social justice for its teachers. That this retraction occurred in Niles Township, District 219, is significant, given the diversity of the student body. Over 67 languages are spoken in the hallways of two schools that serve about 4,500 students from Skokie, Lincolnwood, and Morton Grove. On May 22, 2019, Director of Equity LaWanna Wells sent an email to all faculty who teach in the district listing equity offerings that occur over the summer of 2019. In addition to a racial equity training facilitated by the organization, Courageous Conversations, several opportunities were also sponsored by Teachers for Social Justice, TSJ. According to its website, TSJ is an organization made up of educators who are deeply committed to social justice and work toward classrooms and schools that are anti-racist, multicultural, multilingual, and grounded in the experience of our students. TSJ believes that all children should have an academically rigorous education that is both caring and critical, the website states, an education that helps students pose critical questions about society and talk back to the world. The course offerings included in Wells' email to teachers cover a range of topics such as, if we don't, who will? Tools in surviving and thriving for Black pre-service educators. Another, U.S. imperialism, impact on Honduras. Another, white educators, activists, toward anti-racist teaching, learning, organizing, and finally, teaching Palestine. Wells pasted the information from TSJ directly into the message she sent to faculty. The Teaching Palestine course brings together critical educators who want to teach about Palestine and the Palestine liberation struggle. The course will draw particularly on the resources and knowledge of the U.S.-Palestine Community Network and Jewish Voice for Peace. A week later, after pressure from pro-Israel organizations, the District 219 did a Zionist switcheroo. The May 30, 2019 statement from the district came from Wells and two other district administrators, and noted that people were worried about the one-sided nature of the course and apologized for not providing a more balanced view. The statement denied that teachers would receive credit for taking the course on Palestine, though Wells had stated this in her original email. On May 2nd, the district informed staff of several training opportunities outside of the district related to racial equity and social justice, including sessions offered by a group called Teachers for Social Justice. These summer inquiry to action groups meet on various topics identified and developed by educators throughout the Chicago area. One of the listed sessions is entitled Teaching Palestine. The course was not developed by the district, and the district was never going to provide continuing education credits or lane advancement credit for the course. To an outside observer, and certainly to the Zionist organizations who called out the district, the lack of multiple perspectives surrounding this topic that created a sense of exclusion might seem obvious. It's true that the Teaching Palestine class was not offered alongside a Teaching Israel class, for example, but Zionist history is already taught in the schools, while Palestinian history is consistently and pointedly left out. This course specifically is designed to provide teachers with the skills to teach Palestinian history on schools where Israeli Zionist history remains the default. The objective to discuss creative strategies for how to respond to Zionist professional developments in curricula or when parents, staff, or others object to an anti-Zionist curriculum speaks to the pushback that often occurs when teachers teach about Palestine and designed to empower teachers. TSJ recognizes the imbalance that already exists in schools. Zionism remains the dominant standard, and it offered this course to provide non-Zionist space for teachers to develop strategies for teaching Palestinian history. The uproar from Zionist organization also helped perpetuate the idea that the mere mention of Palestine is a threat to Israel's existence. Any discourse must be squashed. Of course, none of the Zionist organizations attacking the Palestinian course acknowledge the imbalance of Zionist history that already exists in public schools. Any mention of Palestine is considered indoctrination, and that does not encourage coexistence. Several Zionist organizations have also praised District 219's decision to withdraw the course from its offerings, conflating criticism of Israel with anti-Semitism. The Simon Wiesenthal Center released a statement on May 31st commending the district for withdrawing the course from its original offerings. It stated, "Yesterday, under pressure from the Simon Wiesenthal Center, the Niles High School's district canceled the Teaching Palestine course offered for teachers in the Niles Township High School District 219. Superintendent Asoye will be meeting with the Simon Wiesenthal Center's Chicago-based office to discuss bringing the educational resources of the center and their Museum of Tolerance to District 219. We plan to offer the school district educational materials, films, and exhibitions that will help teachers and students alike better understand the complexities of the Middle East." End of quote. Not only has the district canceled the Palestine course, but District 219 Superintendent Desoye has agreed to meet with the Simon Wiesenthal Center to replace the Palestine course with yet another Zionist platform. Not surprisingly, none of these organizations mentioned the power of imbalance that already exists in public schools, indeed, the Israel-Palestine conflict itself. But this isn't new. Retracting the course offering is also one more example of how Zionism remains the dominant standard in public schools, while it simultaneously cries victim in order to justify ignoring Palestine history. That was an excerpt of a Mondo Weiss report written by Liz Rose. It provides a striking example of how the Israeli lobby works. Almost any effort to put forth a Palestinian narrative in this country is met with a well-funded Zionist pushback, which not only seeks to censor the Palestinian voice, but, as is illustrated in this case, also seeks to replace it with a Zionist narrative, which already dominates the discourse. And that is our program this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You'll find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBZ.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday for another edition of This Week in Palestine. This is your host, John Roberts, signing off until next Sunday.